Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, welcome to Unfiltered. My name's Ollie Dugmore, and our guest today is a footballer. Her career began in Holland. Aged just 14, she was too young to sign the contract herself. Since then, she's become the all-time leading scorer in the Women's Super League, scored more goals for the Netherlands than any other player, man or woman, won the Euros, played in the World Cup final, and signed a £250,000 contract extension with Arsenal earlier this year, although that is according to the Daily Mail, so who knows. Despite all the success, she came close to retirement at the age of 18. She said, "I don't really like being the centre of attention, and sometimes I struggle with depression." Ian Wright says, "She's the best number 9 in the world, and she's the best number 10 in the world. There's not many players that can do that." My guest today is Viv Miedema. How's it going, Viv?
All good. How are you?
Yeah, really well, thank you. And all the better for having you here.
Thank you for having me.
What have you been up to?
Rehab, mostly. Obviously, as many know, I've done my ACL in December. I'm 6 months in right now, starting to be on the pitch again. But as you've seen as well, I'm still a bit stiff. So, yeah, a couple more months to go.
I saw a video of you, I think, running for the first time with the new ACL.
Yeah, last week. I've never felt an elephant and a snail at the same time. Although everyone else was saying it looked really, really good for the first time. Yeah, just getting used to it again.
Mm-hmm. And what was it like being back out on the pitch, running, moving like that? Feels good?
Yeah, I mean, good. I was really anxious beforehand, to be fair, because I struggled walking. But they said once I start running, it will loosen off. So I went out on the pitch, all my teammates were there, and that kind of helped me through it because, yeah, the day before I didn't really sleep that well.
I wonder if there's a little bit, I don't know, almost of self-doubt in your mind in a moment like that when you're going to do it for the first time, whether, it might be running or it could be doing some rehab in the gym, putting a bit of stress on it that it hasn't experienced before. You must be sort of doubting yourself about whether you're strong enough or, whether, you know, oh my God, is something, am I going to get injured again or anything like that? It must be all going through your head.
No, definitely. I think throughout the whole process, as you say, like biking for the first time, jumping, running, it's all movements that when you're little, like it's the most normal thing to do. Then once you get injured, your body has kind of let you down. So going back into that, you start overthinking, like, is my knee strong enough? Is my body used to it? Am I ready for this? In a gym throughout the whole process so far, I've been always overthinking everything. So like my physio is like, you can do this, but I need 3 or 4 times before I start believing myself that I can do it. And then once I've got it, like it's fine and I glide through things. But yeah, it is kind of like getting used to a new body. Like it's not my knee anymore. Like there's new ACL on there. Like other things have happened in there. So yeah, it's just small steps.
Especially as well when your body is so central to not just your career, but I guess your sense of self. Getting injured like that, it, you know, if a regular person hurts their ACL, they're kind of like, okay, well, my body's hurt, but I'm the same person. And I guess maybe it provokes broader questions about like your identity and who you are when something as significant as that happens.
I think that's what I've seen with a lot of girls, like throughout my career, a lot of girls are doing their ACLs, which is obviously a sad fact. But for me, I've always seen myself as like being a person and being a footballer. So I think because I've developed myself off the pitch, I struggled less being injured, Although, the first question you get is like, oh, how's your rehab going? How's your knee going? Like, it's always about your knee. It's always about you as a footballer first. I've actually enjoyed bits of not being able to, play at the moment. Like, I've picked up, like, some other things outside of football. Not to have the constant pressure of playing or performing has been quite nice sometimes.
Well, let's do exactly that then and stop talking about the knee and let's talk about you as a person, although... Just before we started recording, you did tell me that your early life was quite boring, so I might regret asking you
this
about this.
This might be a really short podcast.
But we like to begin at the beginning on Unfiltered, so let's do that. How do you remember growing up in your hometown, Hoogeveen?
It was, very quiet, to be fair. Told you it was going to be boring. But no, like, I grew up with my parents in Hoogeveen. Then we moved to a place called Ansen. I don't even think you'll find it on maps. They owned a restaurant. So, like, between me being 4 or 5 years old till, like, I was 10, 11, I basically didn't see my parents that much because they were obviously really busy, like, with the restaurant all the time. My granddad was a chef and my gran was also working in the restaurant. So it was, like, a big family business. My brother came along 4 years after me. So, at one point they got too busy with combining both. Like, we were both playing football. We both obviously had to go to school. So then we moved back to Hoogeveen. Since then, I've only stayed 4 more years there. And then I moved up to Heerenveen already when I was 14.
Who's the best cook in the family then, if it runs like that?
I'm going to say myself, but no.
Really? When I was doing my research for this, I heard quite a few comments about you struggling to cook scrambled eggs and stuff.
In the beginning, like, I really, really struggled. Like, but I'm actually pretty decent now. But yeah, my granddad was a really good chef. My mom was actually really good. I think my dad and my brother are kind of, behind that a bit.
I don't want to skip too far ahead, but realizing that, sort of home comforts when you move away, and we'll talk about your move to Bayern later, but I imagine just like a home cooked meal from your family was probably something that really you perhaps started to miss when you moved away.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think especially the first time when I moved to Heerenveen, I was so used to coming home from school, mum having my dinner ready, then heading to training, that you missed the rhythm, but I mostly miss the meals. And obviously, even like when I was younger, like I loved my granddad was actually, he was in a wheelchair. He had a car accident when he was 20. And he was the very first chef in Holland with a disability that cooked for the queen, which is quite a cool story.
That is cool.
But because he was in a wheelchair, I was always allowed to like stand on the little steps in between. And then like he was just teaching me how to cook and cut things and how to mix things together. So it was obviously like it's little things that you still think about quite a bit. My granddad obviously wrote down recipes and everything, so although I'm not home anymore, I am still having the home cooked meals. Not as good as he did, but I'm getting close.
Getting closer every day. Did he go and watch you play as well as a younger player?
Yeah, he was a massive football fan. That's kind of what started. Like, obviously my granddad and my dad, they were both, well, my granddad was a massive fan and my dad was playing. So I didn't really have a choice when I was younger. He was there all the time. So if my mom and dad couldn't bring me, it was like my grandparents going with me. Sad thing about it was that he was an Ajax fan. So from young age, I was a Feyenoord fan. So it always was against each other, which was quite nice, to be fair. Even one of, I think, the most beautiful moments in my career was when we won the Euros, obviously, in 2017. And I scored on the site that the disability rank was. So like the moment I scored and I turned around, I just seen my grandparents sit in the crowd and they were both crying. And yeah, that obviously had like a massive impact on me on the pitch. And then after that as well, like it's one of those moments you'll never forget.
Yeah, it's amazing. Talk to me a little bit more about your family dynamic, your parents and you and your brother.
I'm really close with my brother. He is 4 years younger than me, so he's 23 right now. But yeah, growing up together and both loving football, you just really grew very closely to each other really quickly. One of the nice things about it as well was that when I started playing for Heerenveen, he was in their youth academy. So we got picked up together after school to go in like this little mini bus. And then obviously he done his thing, I done my thing, got back in the car again. So like we've always had that special connection. Obviously throughout his career, my career, like if we want to know something or we kind of had to make a big decision, like it was always us two like kind of sorting each other out. Which must have been quite difficult for my mom and dad sometimes, maybe because we were so close, we on early age felt like we didn't need our mom and dad anymore. I hear that a lot still. But yeah, they've always been there for me as well. Like my mom and dad are always in the stadium when they can. They like to come over to England. So I've got a really small family, which is probably good because sometimes it can get quite heated. But yeah, it's only the five of us right now. So
if I was to ask you, if your brother was sat in that chair and I was to ask him to describe you, what do you think he'd say? How would he talk about you?
Probably like quite similar to him. So when it's just us two or when it's people around us, like we kind of like being in the background, not the center of attention, he'd probably say that I'm very honest, which I think is a good thing. Some people struggle with it.
Honesty is a good thing, surely.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, I'm Dutch, so we are quite direct, which along the way in my career sometimes have put me in difficult situations. But you live and you learn for the other ones, not for me. So, but yeah, he would definitely say that I'm very caring, always, yeah, there for everyone in the family. And yeah, I would probably say the same thing about him as well.
Mm-hmm. I know this is quite a common experience for a lot of women when they first start playing football, is that they end up playing for boys' teams rather than with girls. I understand that was the same case for you. What are your first memories playing on the football pitch?
Just with boys, as you say, like all my friends, they were all boys, like used to just wake up in the morning before we go to school and like ring all the doorbells and be like, come on, let's play. Then started playing for Hasselt Vivaan, Hoogeveen, later went to VV De Weide. Always played with the boys as well. I was mostly the only girl, but we had one or two seasons that there was like a another girl with me in the team. But I always felt like one of the boys. And then the moment that the game was done or the Saturday was done, then I obviously had like my girlfriends as well in school. So I've never seen it as an issue. I also think that is due to how good the boys were with me.
Mm. And what about the boys on the opposition team?
They were laughing sometimes, but I made sure that they weren't laughing anymore after the game.
Bang a couple of hat-tricks in, job done.
Yeah, so we play FC Groningen, which is obviously like a high, like a first division team. And the boys were laughing. They were like, oh, they've got a girl, so it's going to be an easy game. Then it was like, I think it was 3-0 at halftime to them. And then second half, I came out and I scored 5 goals. And we actually won the game. And one of the boys actually came up to me and he was like, I'm so sorry for my teammates, but you were really, really good today. And I was like, that's probably the nicest thing someone has said to me so far. So yeah, it was always like really nice to be part of, yeah, a boys team.
I was reading that one of your earliest memories involves you having your front teeth kicked out. Is that right?
Yeah, it's not actually my front teeth. It was like the back teeth, I think. We had a little tournament and I went like for a 50-50 with the goalie and I was like, I'm not going to give up. And the goalie basically just came out with like feet up. And my mom and dad were like mortified when they seen me on the floor, obviously, because there was blood everywhere and like I had cuts. I had cuts under my eye as well, so I needed a couple stitches. But since then, I've been more careful with 50-50s, to be fair.
Possibly for the best. And what about footballing icons, people that you looked up to from a young age?
I'm a Feyenoord fan, so it was like Robin van Persie, Dirk Kuyt, Thomas Buffel. Basically that golden generation, because they obviously won the UEFA Cup in 2002, which I went to the semi-finals before. I went to the stadium with my dad and we were sitting like behind the hooligans. And all night they were just smoking weed. And in the back, like on the way back in the car, I was like, Dad, like I've got such a sore head. Like I feel like everything is turning around me. And he was like, must have been the weed from during the game. So great experience. Wanted to go back to the stadium the next week. But yeah, I've always been a Feyenoord fan, so I looked up to them players. And then obviously once you get a bit older, you start following them, you start like watching the games here in England, like obviously Robin first at Arsenal, then at Man U. Yeah, so that was yeah, he probably had the biggest influence on my career and the way I play as well.
Throughout all of these early years, you're playing with lads, your footballing icons are men as well. Were you conscious of the fact that there weren't really any, for want of a better word, famous female footballers for you to look up to? Did it just feel natural? You weren't really conscious of it at the time?
No, I generally think till the age of 12, 13, I thought I was just going to play for Feyenoord, for the national team. You don't realise, I think, at a younger age, at that moment in time, that they've got a women's team and that there is women's leagues, which is obviously a great development for women's football over the last couple of years. Mm-hmm. That when you go to your games, like, you've got girls with Williamson on the back, with Miedema in Holland. But yeah, for me, I always thought, oh, I'm one of the boys now, so I'll be one of the boys later.
Okay, so at 14, you get that offer to play in the top Dutch women's league, and your parents had to sign the contract for you because you were so young. How did you come to make that decision? Because obviously, so you mentioned your relationship with your brother. Did you sort of talk it through with him, talk it through your parents? Could you talk me through that process?
I was speaking with my mum and dad, obviously, at that moment, because they had to sign it for me. So even if I wanted it and they weren't allowing me to, it would have been a different story probably all along. Yeah. But I remember I started playing national team when I was 13 for the under 15s. And I was speaking to a couple of the girls who had been playing with boys, then made a step to, like, it was basically like a team in between. So it was like a second team for, like, the professional clubs. And they were like, I think it's really good if you make the step because it becomes more professional. You become seen by the national teams. So I decided to make the step because it was easy because I could travel with my brother. And I wasn't too far away. And obviously the boys at that age, like 14, 15, they start going out on Friday night, like little parties. And I was like, no, I want to be a professional. So yeah, then when Heerenveen came along, it was quite an easy choice.
An easy choice to make. Then you get there. Was there a degree of intimidation, maybe? I mean, 14, I'm thinking of myself, if I was to, at that age, go into a sporting environment competing with pros, you know, 30-year-old players, I'd find that to be a very intense experience.
Yeah, I think it was both ways. Like, I think it was really intense for me, but also for the other girls, because I walked into a changing room with women who were like 30 years old, had been playing professional for 10 years, work alongside of it, because obviously that was what was needed. And I walk in there as a 14-year-old with my backpack on because I just came straight from school and I had to do my maths homework. And they were like, oh, like, how are we going to deal with this? Like, how are we going to help her? How are we going to treat her? Because at that moment in time, there was no protection either for, like, me being younger. So I struggled the first couple months. But luckily enough, like, my two best mates now, Maruska and Ingrid, they were at the club as well. And they kind of just helped me out with everything. So I started to feel more comfortable. They helped me with my homework. They made sure that if I did do something wrong, they would tell me off. Yeah, and they've just really helped me. And then the second year, I just turned 16 for the second season. And yeah, it just felt normal. And I was just one of them.
Was there ever, it's good to hear you had obviously friends on the team. Was there ever any tension? Because I guess, like, I didn't think about it from the flip side. You just saying it there, you know, if you're an established pro, an older player, and then, you know, a young girl comes in, you're almost, probably feel a little bit insecure, right? Like the next generation coming up and taking a spot in the team or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, we've had a couple of difficult situations because I was like 15 when the season started. And then my second game I came on, I scored a goal, I think. And then the week after that, I was meant to start. But we had a couple girls that were obviously older, but they played national team as well. So then he had to make the decision between me and one of the girls that played for the national team at that moment in time. And then obviously he picked me, which kind of, yeah, caused a bit of issues, like, within the changing room and, like, obviously saying, like, oh, but she's only 15. Like, she's got time. She doesn't need to play right now. But at that moment in time, I was good enough, which I'm probably quite grateful to the coaches I had there. Like, they would just make that decision and they would just let me play. And I think I've always paid that back in goals. So
repaid the faith.
Yeah, exactly. So, but yeah, it was difficult sometimes because, I mean, I can understand that if I come back from my ACL now and I'm in form and I do well, but there's like a 15, 16-year-old that would come through and take your place, like it must be quite difficult.
Yeah, I'm sure. How did you navigate that scenario? Because, you know, at 15, you don't really have the sort of emotional intelligence or the kind of just the experience of being through something like that in the past to draw on and navigate it. Must have been a really difficult time for you, perhaps, those moments. Or
yeah, like certain moments definitely were. Like I remember as well, like I was actually quite good in school, so I was very well behaved. Always done my homework. I really like school, so that obviously helped. But then,
what was your favorite subject?
Maths and history. So great combination. Doesn't really help you along the way.
Good for adding up all the goal records, I guess.
Yeah, true. But yeah, like I think obviously then when you turn 15, 16, like you kind of get into your puberty's time, and instead of misbehaving at school, I sometimes was quite a rebel in training because things either got too easy for me or I've had such a long day that I was quite tired in training. And sometimes because I knew I could get away with it, like I was just a bit of a rebel. And then obviously like I had girls and coaches around me who were really good with that, and they would just tell me off and they would be like, come on, focus now, or like up your game. But it must not always have been easy for them to handle me and deal with me in that sense either, which along the way, because I had to grow up so quickly, I had to be more mature with that as well. So I think it's only helped me for the rest of my career. Like, I mean, I am still a bit of a rebel and session killer sometimes, but I just like to be challenged. And the moment that's not happening and it becomes too easy, I'm like, come on, like, I want to go to that next level, so help me.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was quite difficult sometimes. But as I said, I had my two best mates around me and that helped me through it.
As well as best friends, any mentors or role models that you're still in touch with now that have sort of been with you from those early years of your career?
Yeah, my second coach, Jessica Thorny, she's now head coach for Feyenoord. But yeah, she's really helped me through it. Like, she was really patient with me. She would understand if I had stress from school going on, or like the pressure going into national team, because I started playing national team at that time. I was 16, 17 and I started scoring goals. So they were like, oh, she's going to help us to the World Cup. She's going to help us win the World Cup. And I was like, I've never been here. Like, I've never had this much attention before. Like, please help me. And yeah, she really guided me through that in the early years.
So is that pressure, and I'd like to talk about that in more detail later on, but just at this age when you're already sort of on the up and people are starting to pay attention to you, were you feeling that pressure at that time? It was either media speculation or people in, you know, the game, other players talking about you, singling you out. You felt it at that early age as well?
Yeah, I think my last season at Heerenveen that started, like, I came from, like, my first season scoring 10 goals to then the second year, I think I scored 27, which I was already top goal scorer from the league at that point. But then leading into the third year, that's when I started playing national team. They were like, oh, she's got it in her to score 40 goals. I think that season I ended up with 41, so I done quite well. But I wasn't playing at a team that was going to win the league, so it was quite hard for me to actually like get those numbers. And then the moment I wouldn't score for two or three games in a row, there was always directly from the media like, oh, like she's not performing, she's not good enough, she's not ready for the next step, like she can be playing for national team. Where, yeah, that was new. Like that was new for all of us because women's football had never had that much attention. So then leading into the World Cup, I came off a year that I transferred from Heerenveen to Bayern, so from semi-pro to professional, training three times, four times a week to six, seven times a week. I was tired. Like I went into that tournament in Canada, like not knowing what was going to happen, how much pressure I would feel. And yeah, obviously looking back at that, like it wasn't what I expected it to be at all.
Mm. Can you tell me a little bit more about the Bayern transfer? Because like you said, semi-pro to pro, but also culture shock, and you didn't speak the language when you made the move.
No German, no English. So yeah, I was 17, had a great season at Heerenveen, and then there were like a couple of clubs that were really interested. So I went to see, I think at that moment, PSG, Bayern, Rosengard, because at that moment in time, Sweden was still top league, and I just had the best feeling with Bayern. I think they wanted to make the next step, and I could be part of the next step. So like I would be part of a development. They hadn't won the league in a long time. So I thought, this is nice because it's a step in between. So I can develop and I can help, hopefully help them develop into like this, top class German team. So made the step, got in Munich, and I ended up living with Nora Holstad and Katie Steng, also a Norwegian and, an American girl. And first month, I don't think I've actually spoke a word to them. I had no idea what to say. I was just like pointing at things and I was like, please help me. Like, I don't know how to do this.
You're just being really rude. Didn't want to talk to them.
Yeah. Like, I mean, obviously, like, my mom went over with me first and her English was perfect. So she could kind of tell them, like, oh, like, her English isn't that good yet. Like, she's going to work on her German. So they had to be patient with me. But then I think because I got there and I was injured a lot the first year because I wasn't used to the intensity and training and around that. I spent a lot of time with them. And then obviously after 6-7 months, I was like fluent in English, better in German. And that really helped me set up right for like my second and third year.
How many languages can you speak now?
3.
What's the best way to learn them? Is it literally just the conversation? Are you taking lessons? Like, how does it work?
Yeah, to be in a country. I think once you, especially in Germany, like you need to. They weren't always happy with my accent because I did still sound a bit Dutch, which obviously is a bit sensitive to some people. You need to be around them and need to feel comfortable enough. I think what stopped me from speaking German early on is because I got too shy in actually speaking it. So I would only speak it if we had won the league the first and the second year, and we had a party. So like I had a couple beers in me, and that's when I started speaking German, and the girls were like, wow, like you're unbelievable, like you understand everything, like you can speak it, why do you not do it? And I was like, I just get really nervous like speaking it when I'm around you guys and whatever. And so after that they were like, no, we're gonna speak German with you, there's no way back now. I was like, okay.
I hope they hadn't been speaking like, you know, you're in earshot and they're having a conversation about you in German thinking they can't understand, you can't understand what they're talking about, and the whole time you're listening in or anything like that.
No, never had that. But to be fair, if they would have done that, I probably would have just pulled them up right there and then and be like, can I join in, speak about myself? So, yeah.
You talk about the accent. You've got a little bit of a Scottish twang, I think, in your English as well. Where's that come from?
I'm not going to lose that anymore.
Yeah.
My ex-girlfriend, like Lisa, she's Scottish. So when we started dating in Munich, like that's obviously when I went from being decent in English to then being better and better. And like I picked up so many things from her, then from Emma Mitchell, Kim Little. So I don't think I will be losing it anymore.
So, like you said, you're starting to get into the international team. I think first game, you get about 5 minutes. Second international game, get 15 minutes and you score a hat trick. They haven't really dropped you since then, have they?
No, that was me in. I remember that because like first game was Albania away. That whole trip, I was so, so nervous to be away with them. I was like, wow, these are the big girls, and I was like, I'm not ready for this yet. Got a couple minutes, then against Portugal came on for 15, and I think I touched the ball 3 times and 3 of them went to top corner, and I was like, oh god, like this is gonna go really quick right now. So then the game after that was my first start against Norway, never really been back out since.
In moments like that throughout your career, do you ever have to try and just sort of stop and absorb what's happening to you? Like you said there, it was, you know, 3 touches, 3 goals and it's gone so fast. Do you ever find yourself trying to sort of sit back and be like, you are here, I'm on the pitch, I've just done this? And does it, because I, with really intense experiences like that, it can almost fly by and you don't absorb it.
Nah, to be fair, like I'm really, really bad in that. And I think one of the reasons, like, I mean, Beth always says like things happen for a reason, and I'm like, no, they don't. Like, You can work for them, or like sometimes yes it happened, but like there doesn't need to be a special reason behind that. But I think now I have been injured, like I have had a lot more time to reflect on things. I've obviously been extremely busy, like we've played a Euros, a World Cup, an Olympics and another Euros all within 5 years, and I've never had the time to settle down and be like, wow, this was amazing to be part of, or I've done really well here, or I should have done better here. Like there's not been much time to reflect on things. And for me as well, like I never really live in the here and now. Like if we last summer or like the summer before at the Olympics, like I was in form. I scored every single game. But after the games, the girls came up to me and they were like, oh my God, you were amazing today. Or like, let's do this and this. And I was like, no, like, we've got a game again in 2 days. Like, I need to prepare for the next game. So I think if anything, like, I need to really get better in trying to live in the here and now and enjoy moments.
There's kind of a balance to be struck there though, right? Because do you get to the position you're in to enjoy those moments if you don't have that singularity of focus and you don't have that drive to be thinking about, okay, well, we've done that. Who cares? We're on to the next thing.
Watch out for the light, Viv.
I know. Big elbows from the gym. one of the reasons I did get so far in football must have been because I'm extremely driven and I want to do well and I want to perform and on and off the pitch, obviously. At the same time, I think if I probably would look back on my career with a lot more enjoyment if I do allow myself to have those moments and to be really happy about what we've done as a team mostly. I think you need to have a mix in it. I think if you go one way, either way, it's probably not healthy and it's probably not what you want to get out of your career.
In terms of those happiest moments, would you say that captaining the national side was one of them?
It's a proud moment. Like, I think every time you put on your national team kit and you go out and you sing your anthem, it's just a special feeling. You can't compare it to club football. You can't compare it to winning something with your club. Like, it's just, it's really nice to play for your country. That's me saying that, although sometimes I wish I was Scottish because I love Scotland. But, it was a proud moment. And I think especially for me, like, I've done it over the last couple of years, like a couple of times when the girls came off, like when Sari from Veenendaal or Sherida came off. But for me in that game against France to be captain after I had just had COVID was a really special moment, to be fair.
Could you talk about that feeling a little bit more for someone who is never going to represent their country at any sport? You said it was a special feeling. Try and explain it to me. Like, what does it feel like when you're stood there, you're singing the anthem, the shirt's on? What are you thinking about at that moment in time?
I think I see it not as much as me representing the country. I see it as me like representing all the young girls that are playing football. So I see myself as a role model within football, and that is part of it. So like, I get to put on that shirt, I get to captain the country, I get to score goals for the Netherlands by hoping that I'm inspiring the next generation. It's not so much about me or about my family. Like, I know that they love being in the stadium, I love being there, but I think the thing that's keeping me going to play football right now is probably that I feel like we've still got a lot to do for the young girls out there. And that's probably one of my biggest motivations. Like, and one of the proudest things you can probably get from your career is like, inspiring young girls to be just like you.
So what do those next steps, next successes look like then? Because I was going to say, you know, more personal accolades than I can probably accurately count. I tried. There's so many different lists. It's hard to knock them all up. Same for team results. Does the sort of the next stage of success for you, is it on the pitch? Is it off the pitch?
I think it's a bit of both still. I think before I got injured, I've had so many thoughts about like, how long do I still want to do this? What do I still want to win mostly? Because obviously I've been lucky enough to win a Euros at home. I've played a World Cup final. I've played in Olympics. What is realistic to still win? One of the things people say to me is like, oh, you need to win the Champions League. And I was like, well, if it happens, it happens. If not, then okay. But I think while being injured now, like for me, if I want to come back, there's only one way of coming back, and that's trying to be better than I have been before and win things with the club, with the national team. And the focus outside of the pitch will definitely be on letting the game grow in Holland, in England. I think, obviously, I'm a World Child Ambassador. I work with Common Goal. I want, children, not just girls, like children in general, like to have equal opportunities and opportunities to start playing football and sports. And sometimes that doesn't need to be football. Sometimes that is going to be tennis or athletics or gymnastics. But we need to give children the freedom and a chance to find out what they want to do.
And I really want to talk to you about that in a bit more detail later on.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
We've spoken about the highs, so we need to talk about the lows as well. You mentioned that World Cup in 2015. I mentioned in the introduction that you considered retiring after that World Cup. You've mentioned that you were tired and that the pressure was already mounting before you got there. So maybe it's best for me to just kind of ask you to talk about that tournament, the before, the after, you know, in your own words rather than putting them in your mouth.
First of all, I was really young. I was only 18. I had never been away from home to the other side of the world for longer than a week. So being in Canada with the team for 5 weeks was a big step. The year before, we played the playoffs to get to the World Cup, and we played Italy at home and away. At home, we played 1-1, and away we won 2-1, and I scored all 3 goals. So going into the World Cup, all the media were like, oh, Miedema is going to help us win the World Cup, which was unrealistic anyway, because it was our first World Cup with Holland. Like, we'd never been there before, so it was already something like a big step for us to even go. I think then going to, like, arriving in Canada, as I said, like, I've had a long season, multiple injuries, wasn't top fit going there, and the moment we landed, I just got really, really stressed. We had a bit of a different team, like, older generation, only a couple young girls. It was quite hard to fit in, and yeah, just being there and playing the first couple games, like, I didn't score a goal, so then you kind of put pressure on yourself, and yeah, media in Holland can be quite negative and direct. So yeah, I had to find out in that way. And during the tournament, I remember, like, at that moment calling my boyfriend Stefan a lot, calling the family and be like, oh, like, what can I do? Like, what is best for me to do? But they had never been in that situation or position before either. So they didn't really know what to do or how to help me. And yeah, throughout the tournament, I lost a lot of weight because, like, I just didn't have the energy or even, like, almost, like, confidence to, like, keep eating and just doing the normal things. And, yeah, getting back home from that World Cup, I think, was really tough, like, because the build-up was so intense and you were so excited to go. And then it was this massive disappointment. And I was like, if this is how I'm going to be feeling the rest of my career or every single big tournament, I do not want it anymore. And then obviously on top of that came that I had to go back to Munich 2 weeks later. And I was like, I want to be comfortable. I want to be with my friends and my family. So I don't want to go back. But yeah, my mom thought different about that. And I am quite happy that, yeah, she did.
So did you, even though it's obviously not just, it's not your fault, do you know what I mean? It's a team game always. But you felt personally responsible, or you felt a degree of personal responsibility for how the team performed?
Not even so much performance-wise, to be fair. Like, I think we got to the round of 16, which for a World Cup was already a big step, like getting out of the group. I didn't score, but I didn't play extremely terrible either. Obviously, I would have liked to be able to score a couple of goals and help the team, but circumstances considered, it wasn't too bad. So yeah, I never blamed myself for that. I think the only thing that after the tournament and knowing now, it's not even blaming, like, I just wish that I would have done things differently. Like, I wish that, not just me, like, I wish that within women's football, within our association, within the team at that moment, like, people had helped me, they had like people had played tournaments before, they had more experience than me. Like I needed someone to be there for me. And I had to be more open for that. I was quite closed off. So instead of me going out and be like, please help me, I went within myself and I tried to block everything and everyone around me out of it, which, yeah, I can only try and help young players right now to, yeah, help prevent them to go through that. We've got one young girl at national team right now. Her name is Vika. She's 17 and she's going to her first World Cup. So when I was in camp last weekend, I was like, make sure you find your moments to call with your family, speak to the girls. There's no pressure on you. Like, it's a bit different because she's not going to go there, play, and they don't expect her to win it for them. But yeah, just give her little tips and be like, try and be open for the help around you and the experience around you. And yeah, I really needed someone like that in 2015, but that person just wasn't there.
So you come back from the tournament. I mean, how close were you to quitting? Because I think I saw in that interview you said to your mum that you were going to or wanted to. How close were you to it?
Yeah, like I spoke again to Jessica Torney, so the person that has helped me through the first 3 years. And I was like, I don't want to do this anymore. She was like, why not? So then I gave my reasons. I was like, I don't want to deal with the pressure. I don't want to having to go away to the other side of the world and not be with my family and friends. And she was like, but what do you get back for it? And I was like, nothing. And then I just hang up. And she was like, okay. So then she obviously had a chat with my mom and dad as well. And then my mom was like, it's not always going to be easy. Like, just, she didn't really put pressure on me for saying, like, you need to go back to Munich and you need to keep playing for, like, another 10 years. But she was just like, go back, see how you feel, and go from there. I did actually speak with my Bayern coach at that moment as well, Thomas Werle. And I was like, this is how I feel. And if I don't feel better after preseason, then that's it. Which I luckily did feel a bit better after preseason. Probably not as good as I wanted to, but I kind of was back at my normal level, normal weight as well. So I felt fresher. And then the first game of the season, it couldn't have started any better for me, to be fair. Like, I think I scored a couple goals and that kind of got me back into that flow. And then the next big decision was there because I had to turn up for national team again after. And I was set in stone on not going and saying, like, I want time off. I'll return again once some of the girls have left or once I feel better myself. But yeah, then Jessica Torney and Sarina Wichmann convinced me to come back into camp.
Have you found in each of the conversations we've had about sort of how you're feeling in a moment and also how you're doing on the pitch, how directly connected are the two?
For me, massively. I think a lot of players might be different, but like, I play my best football on the pitch when I'm happy off it. I've always been like that. Once I feel free and I feel like I can control myself off it, I feel like then football is like a motivation and a high for me, where if I struggle off the pitch for whatever reason, if I go through just a difficult period of time or go through anxiety, football isn't like a relief to me then. Like, it builds up extra pressure, which I think a lot of players might understand. A lot of them won't understand because they see football as like, that's my distraction. I'm going onto the pitch. Everything else doesn't matter. But I'm different in that sense. So like, if I struggle off the pitch and I go onto the pitch, I take my struggles with me on the pitch. I start getting frustrated with myself, with my teammates, which again, I think over years I've become better and better in to like try and disconnect them from one another, unless I'm happy, because then I want to take that onto the pitch with me. But I've been working with a psychologist for like 5-6 years now and trying to just be as open as I can be to see if that would help me into a better player, but mostly be more happy and, well, more often happy off the pitch.
Has it worked? Are you more happy?
Well, sometimes. We've obviously, like, I've had like a ridiculous 6-7 months, to be fair, obviously, with like me and Beth both doing our ACLs, her mom passing away. There's been a couple issues back at home as well. And like, it has been really tough, but somehow, as I said before, like because I've not had the pressure of having to perform on the pitch, I've had time to process things and just try and fix them up directly. I feel a bit more free than I felt in the past. And I think, I mean, wisdom comes with age. I'm not that old, but
I know
in football years, I'm starting to feel old.
I'm not sure about that. I felt that when I was looking at these questions and writing and thinking about it, and you know, looking back, being like, "Oh, do you remember that World Cup?" And it's like, "You're only 26 years old."
I have been around for like 12 years now. I'm going into like my 13th professional season, where a lot of players will be happy if they even get it to 13. So all the girls, like at national team, at Arsenal, like I'm not the oldest one, but I am probably one of the most experienced ones. So that comes with pressure, that comes with expectations, and I'm happy to have them, I'm happy to carry them. But I think the most important thing along every single journey I've had so far is that I've started to realize it's not me against the world. I just need people around me that can help me along the way and keep me right.
So you mentioned this last season, and I saw on your Instagram you described it as what a season of extreme lows as well as unreal highs, and quote, on a personal level, the toughest one yet. How much of that is the stuff you just spoke about, you know, in relation to football, i.e. injuries to you and Beth, or is it the stuff that's happening off there? I mean, you mentioned Beth's mum passing, so
it's definitely been both. I think if you go back to summers, like Euro summer, I obviously went into that tournament with high expectations of myself. I've had a good season. I felt good. The lead-up game to it, like against Finland, I scored 2 goals. I played good against Sweden, and then I got COVID. Been in my bed for 10 days, missed 2 games, which has been a really weird experience, to be fair, like to be at the Euros, but to not be at the Euros. Then I played against France, but I probably shouldn't have played because I wasn't recovered like enough to play 120 minutes anyway. The Euros ended up being a massive disappointment for me personally, but then at the same time for England and women's football in England, it was probably the best summer ever. So heading back into the season, I wasn't fit. I was still recovering from COVID. Like I must have had long COVID somehow. So I started playing every single minute again, started scoring goals, felt good. And then in October, I was like burned out. I was like, I don't want to play. Like I need to get away. Pulled out of national team in the October camp and said to Jonas and the club, I was like, it's been too much. Like I need time to recover and switch off. So I went home for a weekend, got back into training and playing, and the same thing just happened. Like I started playing, I didn't enjoy it, I got really tired, and I was like, in November, I was like, no, like I need to get away, which I took quite literally because I went to Australia. I booked a flight on the Friday night and I left on the Monday morning. So
as far as you can get, isn't it?
Yeah. So I was 24 hours away, went to see my best mate, Mroz, switched off from football for 2 weeks completely. And I came back and I was like, I feel good, like I'm ready. Played 4 or 5 games, scored every single game, probably got back to how I should be playing, and then done my ACL. So, it's been really up and down. Like, I think mentally, physically, like, it's been one of the toughest years, not just for me, but with all the injuries we've had at Arsenal. I mean, we've obviously had 4 ACLs and, like, a couple of big injuries, which comes with the increase of games, with the girls playing big tournaments in summers now. You see it all over Europe at different clubs. To be part of that team and to having to pick other girls up when they're feeling really low, like, it's obviously mentally quite tough. But the only thing I can say about that is that I've never played in a team that's been so close and good for one another, going through everything as right now at Arsenal. So that's been, really good and nice at the same time to be part of as well.
There's so much in there that I want to talk about. The first of which
I talk too much, don't I?
No, it's great. It's fascinating. I could listen to you talk all day. To be honest with you, let's start with the breaks, taking breaks for your mental health, because you know, particularly within sport, which I may have said this earlier, you know, it's a very competitive, you know, environment. Everyone's looking for a weakness in their opposition. And I'm sure at times to be able to even just suggest and say, mentally, I need a break, not physically, mentally, I need a break. That must be a hard thing in and of itself before you even start taking the time off and thinking about going back. How important have those breaks been for you, whether it's because you've asked for it or it's been self-imposed because of an injury? How important is that for your sort of mental state to have that time off to reflect?
It's honestly the most important thing. Like, I know that me as a player, like, I've been quite fortunate over the last couple of years to be able to say, like, okay, I need, of course, I've done it before, and I probably will have to do it again. But I've been quite fortunate with me being me that clubs and national teams were willing to help me out. And then the moment I got back and I felt fresh again, like, my level was obviously high enough to then just return to play and be in the team again. So I've never felt like, which is good, I've never felt like anyone has used it against me, which is, I think, is a really important thing. I do understand, though, from a lot of other girls' point of view, like, if you're close to playing but not always playing, you don't want to take 2 or 3 weeks off, because the moment you come back, you're scared you're not going to play. And that's where, obviously, as you say, like, in a competitive environment, it's very difficult to look after yourself. The only thing that I want to advise people is, like, please do so, because I've not done that in the past, and it's led me to a lot of different emotions and difficulties off the pitch that led to, like, panic attacks, obviously depression, and, like, I don't want to let it come that far again. Like, I know myself now. I know when I need to break and say, stop, it's enough. I need my time away. And I've learned that over the years, which, again, I probably don't fully understand myself yet, because, well, I'm pretty sure I don't. But, yeah, just to start and to understand myself, like, I know it's really important for me to be open and honest about that. And the moment that, like, someone would not be able to give that to me, would also mean that I would probably have to move into, like, a different environment.
Mm. And has setting those boundaries helped you with, well, for example, depression or panic attacks? Being able to say, that's my limit, I know where it is, I'm not going past it, it's helped?
Yeah, no, definitely. I think along the way, like, you find ways to deal with situations a lot better. Like, you know, okay, I've done this last time, it didn't work, so I need to adjust it. Or, like, oh, I have done this last time and it worked. So, I think past experiences can help you not fall into the same rhythm, or, like, change how you feel about things and start getting them under control a lot earlier. I also, again, do think that within football, within sports and, like, society in general, mental health is still such a big issue. Like, it's something that you don't really want to be open about or, like, speak about too much, because it can be used against you. So, like, we need to start creating a safer environment, like, within everywhere, for people to say, like, I'm not okay, or, like, I do need help, or I have been struggling with, like, anxiety, panic, like, it's okay. So one of the things that I'm obviously quite close with and, like, have been speaking out about as well. But yeah, like, we need to start accepting that the pressure we do put on players is so much these days, with social media, with fans, with sold out stadiums now, that it's not just leading to big injuries, but it's also leading to people having mental health issues.
So how much of this is to do with the sort of demands of the sort of the season, the schedule, the calendar? Because you mentioned it earlier, right? Really demanding domestic season, European tournaments, domestic tournaments, before we even start talking about the international game and those big summers, you know? And really, unless you do have, well, it's not actually that rare. Quite a lot of people are having these catastrophic injuries. Without them, there's not much of a break. How much of what the women's game is going through, or the female players are going through, is to do with that schedule, do you think?
I mean, it says enough that the injuries have increased over years while the games have been increased. When I started playing football professionally, like, I went from having 20, 30 games a season to now playing, if I play every single game, I'll probably hit 60, 65 games. With that comes that the game around us, so, like, obviously like medical teams, clubs, national teams, they've not had the time and the capacity to develop with the new schedule. We've obviously increased in squad numbers now at Arsenal. Like, I think the club is doing anything and everything they can to like catch up and protect players, but we need help from above. I think it's down to FIFA and UEFA to say, okay, till here and not any further. But they won't, because for them it's about marketing, it's about money, it's about trying to get as many games in as possible within this space and time, to just make money. And in the end, like, we become one of them little like people in the whole bigger picture, but we're not protected. So you see a lot of coaches and players speaking out about, we need to adjust the schedule, we need to make sure that it's not going to increase again. But as long as FIFA and UEFA don't want to do anything with it, we're quite stuck in that sense.
And to be clear as well, it's not just an Arsenal thing. I think the actual divide, it's a gender divide, right? These ACL injuries, they're happening to women much more than they're happening to men. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, it's definitely not just an Arsenal thing. Like, we've been really unlucky that we've had four this season. But if you look around at other top clubs, like, I mean, if you look at the top 20 from the Ballon d'Or this season, 7 at this moment have actually done their ACL. Yes, women are more likely to do their ACL, which I think research has been done over the last couple of years, but no real answers has come up yet. So the only thing we as players need to push for right now is like, keep researching, but also invest within your medical team right now, so that what you've got in place right now is going to be better for girls to hopefully prevent them doing their ACLs.
Mm-hmm. One of the other things you mentioned in that answer that I wanted to talk to you about as well was your popularity off the pitch. And it's kind of connected to the mental health side of things as well, because I think I get the sense that you're quite a private person. You've said that, you know, you don't like being the centre of attention. How have you handled, as the profile of the women's game increases, obviously so does your personal one, your celebrity increases. How have you coped with that, you know, sort of spontaneous interactions with fans and stuff when you're out and about?
I haven't. I haven't really. I am just a really awkward person. Like, when fans come up to me and they shout at me and they want pictures and they're like, oh, you're the best player ever, like, you've made my day, I'm just standing there and I'm like, not really sure what to say. Like, it does feel amazing. Like, and I am happy that I am that person, role model, football player for them. But it's something that I don't think I'll ever get used to. If I go out for dinner in London and, as you say, like, I am quite private. So like, I do like to just go out with my friends or family and not be disturbed. But if people then do it, I always get a bit uncomfortable. I also think it's because the nice thing about women's football is that fans feel really related to us, because we are accessible. Like, we are open to like doing things with them. Like, after the games, we do give like pictures and autographs and everything. But people don't know when to stop or what is too far. Which again, although it's sad to say and to think, sometimes we probably do need to move a bit more to men's football to protect our players. Obviously you hope that fans have got the respect and a good willingness behind it and be like, okay, we'll just do a picture and then that's it. But if I go out and I've got a beer or whatever, like, you can see people videoing you or like making pictures and I'm like, no, that's too far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it, to have, I guess you want to be successful, you want to be at the top of your game. And some of the price you have to pay for that is you lose your anonymity, right? The behaviour that if anyone else was in that pub, no one would be filming that person. You know, I was just having a beer, you know, it's irrelevant, but it's because of who you are. And I think you're right as well to talk about that difference between the women's and the men's game, because I think you watch a game and you see afterwards, all the players are there talking to the fans in the stands, you know, like you said, taking photos, doing autographs. I think it's one of the best things about the game is the connection. You know, it almost feels, like a non-league side. I don't want to make it sound like, you know, I'm doing the game now, but you know how like the players and the fans, they all know each other. And I think that's a proper club feeling. I think it's one of the wonderful things about it. You know, it can be a positive and it can be a negative, can't it?
No, but like, as you say, like, I think that is the beautiful thing about it. And like, that's something that us players, like, we don't want to lose.
Yeah.
Like, we want to be able to say, thank you so much for coming to the game today, make a picture, give them an autograph. But it needs to be a two-way thing. So, like, if we do our bit, then the other side needs to be happy with what we give them.
Mm.
And we don't want to get into situations that players start feeling uncomfortable or even scared to go up the fence and be like, oh, I really hope they don't say anything bad to me today. Or, I mean, especially with social media these days, like, type of abuse that happens on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, like, girls do see that and do feel that. Even if I'm not on a lot of platforms, like, I actually sometimes scroll through Twitter. I'm on Instagram. I've actually got a private Instagram that no one is even allowed to see or follow. I don't want to see things, but you always will see things. And if it's not you seeing it, you'll hear it through either other girls, or you hear it through interviews or people around you. And, like, I think we just need to be a bit more thoughtful of what we say and careful in the way of not trying to, make people struggle a lot with it.
I've always wondered, well, if, you know, someone sees, like, a nasty comment or, like, a tweet, and it's like, oh, did you see someone said this really horrible thing about you?
Yeah, but, like, people...
I didn't, actually. I don't want to know about it.
People see it, and, like, I've had this argument with my mom and dad so many times, because in the beginning, they're not as bad now anymore. Like, they like to see and follow everything about you.
Yeah.
So, like, they want to see all the good things, but the moment they see one bad thing, they start panicking. They're like, oh my God, this has happened. And I'm like, Mom, like, I don't want to know. Like, you can see it if you want to see it, but, like, I'm not seeing it. So I think, again, that's probably a conversation players will need to have with family and friends. To be, especially going to a World Cup now, people are going to have opinions. Women's football has never been watched more than it has been watched right now. So then players need to start saying to their friends and family, we do not want to hear this. Like, we don't want to hear anything about comments, about people's opinions, because then you can protect yourself.
Is there a connection between that, this sort of inner privacy we're talking about, and when you're playing, you don't really celebrate when you score? The two things connected?
I think a bit. I think it just shows a bit of my character. Like, I'm quiet and peaceful in the back of things. I think I'm quite, like, I am respectful as a person, which I think for me, scoring a goal is great. But at the same time, it makes the other team not feel great. So I would not want to celebrate in front of them or annoy them or, get over that line of, like, being disrespectful towards them.
So considerate.
I know. I've obviously had a couple of weird celebrations when I became all-time top scorer for the national team.
I was about to ask you about that.
A big roly-poly. It was a deal with my brother. He was in the stadium in that moment, and he made the video in the morning saying, like, in the first half, you're going to be scoring on that goal, so that means you're equaling it. And then in the second half, you're going to be scoring on this goal, and I'll be sitting right here, so you better do the roly-poly towards me. And I text him back saying, this is never going to happen, but if it happens, I'll do it. So we scored in the first half, and then I scored in the second half on that side, and I was just like, I turned around and I thought, oh, I am going to do this, and then I went for it. It looked really stiff, so it wasn't that good. But yeah, it was obviously one of the big celebrations I've done.
We've been talking about sort of your personal goals, talking about, you just mentioned there, the women's game is at sort of the biggest it's been. Where do you see the next place that it goes to? What do you view as sort of the growth for the game as a whole rather than for you personally?
I think women's football will keep developing for many years from now on. I've always said, I hope it's not going to develop into men's football. I hope it's going to keep some characteristics. We don't need to go to the same money, because it's ridiculous money that's going around in the men's game. And I think the beautiful thing about women's football is that a lot of players are aware of what's going on in the world, what's going on within football. They use their platform for, like, a greater good. We've obviously got girls at Arsenal, again, like, extremely intelligent, with Kim Little doing work with FISA for people in the world, like Lotte Wibben-Moy, who goes out to do charity work through the club with a lot of different girls as well. And yeah, it's not just about money and football. Like, there's so many different things. And I do think, I mean, I don't want England to win everything in the next couple of years, but
you do.
it does come with success. So, like, as long as, like, the national team is doing well and we get people into our league games, it's going to be as easy to marketing, like marketing wise, to actually get people back in. So they need to keep doing well for women's football in England to keep developing. And then I do think that over 2-3 years, we hopefully play in, like, in the Emirates every single league game, and we get 30,000-40,000 people every single weekend.
Mm-hmm. Talking about the financial side of things, you mentioned earlier you work with Common Goal, giving 1% of your salary to the organisation to help further all of these causes, which I'm going to ask you to talk about in a minute. But I guess the flip side is, if you were on that kind of money that the men's game are on, obviously that's more money for charity, right? So it's like, you know, it's not as simple as keeping the cash out of it, maybe. Or
It's both. Like, I mean, as I said, like, don't get me wrong, like, I'm in a fortunate position with what I am getting for my football, for something that I love doing. And then you've obviously got, like, marketing deals around that as well. So yes, my 1% won't go as far as what it does in the men's side. But at the same time, I don't think any footballer needs to earn 50, 100 million a year to be happy with what they can be doing. Obviously, you'd like to think that in a couple of years, we start going into the direction of, like, a lot more footballers donating this 1%, or a lot of footballers doing different projects, like, around, like, besides football. Mm-hmm. So yes, I would love to earn 100 million a year and put that into what, like, I'm, like, adding it to War Child. But it's not realistic, and it's also not something that I think we should be moving into.
Mm-hmm. So could you tell me more about Common Goal and the work that you do with them?
I mean, I've obviously been part of it for a couple of years now. I became an ambassador for War Child beforehand, and I've been lucky enough to actually be able to, like, partner them up. So as I said, like, my addition goes to War Child directly through Common Goal, which they will obviously use for programs, yeah, in war countries. So, like, they're really big in Ukraine right now. Obviously, they've got programs in Syria right now, and it's, for me, that's something really nice to be part of, because again, it comes back to me feeling like I'm a role model and wanting to improve not just the game, but, like, give children opportunities. I can help in that sense with it.
Throughout this whole conversation, I've noticed that this talk about being a role model, how important it is to you that football is a vehicle for something bigger than just the game. I think it's really striking and really impressive. And I wonder why, maybe it's because I don't hear about it, it's not as widespread or as prevalent in, like, other aspects of football. And, you know, I'm sure there are plenty of other good people in the game, right? But I don't know, it just, with you, it seems to be the reason. Do you know what I mean? It's, like, central to what you're doing, whereas perhaps it might not be for other players.
Yeah, I think, as I said, like, we've definitely got girls at Arsenal that are really aware of things, and that probably also use that as one of the factors that they are playing football. As I said, like, I think Lotte is one of the, like, the main examples for it. But yeah, a lot of girls obviously play football just because they love it and because they earn money with it, and they see different cities, different countries. But everyone's got their own motivations in that sense. I do like to believe, obviously, that in men's football and in other sports as well, that you've got a lot of good people out there that are willing to improve their sports, but also the world in its total. I mean, obviously, like, Juan Mata is one of the people that actually set up Common Goal, helped setting it up. So yeah, you've got more than enough good people out there, but sadly enough, we don't hear enough about it because it's probably not as exciting as someone being a rebel and doing something stupid.
Possibly. There's also an extra degree of responsibility that comes with it, though, as well, right? You know, if people look up to you, I guess, like you just said, right, you don't really want to be rebelling. You don't really want to be doing stupid things because there are people that are looking up to you as a role model, and perhaps that can manifest itself as an additional pressure, you know?
Yeah, for me it doesn't, though, because I think everything I do comes back to how I would want to be treated. So I would never do something that would make myself feel uncomfortable if someone else would do it to me. So it kind of just comes back to how I've been taught to be from my mom and dad. So, like, how I grew up, I think because it comes quite natural to me, like, I don't feel it like a big heavy weight on my shoulders. Like, obviously, as I said, sometimes I do feel that weight on my shoulders, but it's from a performing side of things. It's not from the development side of things. Like, I think I get a lot of energy out of it. So instead of having a day off and going to the cinema, going to having a coffee with the girls, like sometimes I go to one of the centers from War Child, or I go play football with girls from the foundation, which Lotta obviously does as well. And like, that brings me energy. So I think it works, again, it works two ways. Like, I get energy from doing it, and hopefully my energy helps them from like developing.
I know we said earlier that you've still got plenty of time left to play. You know, it's not like a time to be doing big retrospectives about your career, but, you know, in the future, when you look back, what would you like your legacy to be?
I mean, I think on the pitch, I've worked quite well on that already. I've always said I wanted to be top goal scorer from the national team, which I am. I am going to reach them 100 goals pretty soon, hopefully. But I think off the pitch, like, I would love to be able to be part of, development of women's football in Holland. I think I am part of that already, together with, like, well, Sari van Veenendaal a lot. We've made massive steps with our association to provide the youth teams, the national team, from, just being world-class with facilities, with opportunities, financially, everything. But I don't think we're done yet. Like, I think we still got the responsibility to bring the women's game to a higher level. And that's not just us playing in the Emirates in front of 60,000 people, but that's also with, well, England putting in the law that every single girl needs to be able to play football in schools. There's so many steps we still need to make. And it's something that right now I've got time for anyway, to brainstorm and to make sure that we start up a couple projects that are helping that development.
With me tomorrow. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear, and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.